And our special guest tonight, Terry Hayes, talking about his latest work, I Am Pilgrim. And we will be back in a moment as we talk more about the future on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Terry Hayes with us. Terry, let's get into, of course, the possibilities. I know we don't want to give away the entire story of I Am Pilgrim, but are there any winners here at all?
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously the agent who is codenamed Pilgrim has to go on this sort of globetrotting and quite incredible adventure, and he's telling us the story. This is, you know, the most you know, hugest thing he's ever dealt with. So I think we can deduce from that that he survives, and that, but you know, he's there's an expression that a man is, you know, a man can be broken like a butterfly on a wheel, and I think that's what happens to him. So yeah, the story is, I think, at the end very positive, because we have averted disaster. But more importantly, looking at it on a slightly broader level, I think there is one winner, and that is that it's an attempt to bring to the attention of a much wider audience than I would reach, you know, if I was writing a newspaper article or that, the dangers that confront us. And, you know, whilst it is a story of fiction, the underlying plot devices of it are unfortunately based on fact. But, you know, so from my point of view, I sort of think that, well, I did my bit.
You sure did.
I tried to raise a warning.
Paul Revere.
Yeah.
What do they think of us in Australia, Terry?
Well, you know, well, personally, I of course, I have a huge affection for America. My wife's American. My kids are American. Every time that the president comes on TV and speaks about path to citizenship and, you know, illegal immigration and aliens and all of that, my kids yell out and say, "Hey, Dad, come and watch this. This is about you." I said, "What do you mean it's about me?" And they say, "Well, you're the only alien in this household, you know, because they're all American." So I have I have a vested interest in this. For the country at large, of course, we've fought so many wars together, you know, First World War. Some of them were, you know, righteous wars, and some unfortunately weren't. But we tended to be there. We're a very small country, 22, 23 million people. But I think we've punched above our weight in many conflicts. And the most important thing in Australian foreign policy is our relationship with America. That's not to say that there's not differences and, culturally differences. I think the largest criticism that can be made is that we, and I think this is true of most everywhere in the world, that American culture, you know, popular culture, movies, music, TV, all of these things, tends to overwhelm a lot of the local culture. Yes. So, you know, if you were to turn the TV on in Australia, I mean, it could be in America. And that, I think a lot of people feel that, you know, this is a huge and powerful in most instances, a wonderful country, but it can steamroller you a bit. So, you know, I think that causes some resentment. But my in-laws who live in Nevada come to Australia all the time and are totally blown away by the friendliness of people, the generosity of people towards visitors and that. And I think underneath it all, I think there's a great affection in Australia. I mean, when Australia was, you know, under a huge threat from Japanese invasion, it was the Americans that stood with us. And I don't think that generation ever forgot it. And I think that's, you know, become part of our national approach to things. So, yeah, it's a very close relationship. But that's not to say that there's not criticisms. And I think you'll hear Australians berating your president pretty much like a lot of Americans do.
I think so, too. With what's been going on this planet over the past, 50 to 100 years, the Aussies were with us during World War II, so were the Canadians. There's such a camaraderie there that, you know, if people would stop to think of the relationship we've had, we wouldn't have any differences at all.
Yeah, absolutely. That is so true. You know, I mean, especially in this week of the D-Day, 70th anniversary. Yeah, and that
was emotional.
Oh, incredibly. So emotional. And, you know, the Canadians, of course, were just beyond heroic on those, you know, incredible days. I mean, the beaches they were involved in were, not that there were any good beaches, but were some of the worst. Australians, I've been to many, many of our war graves all throughout Europe and unfortunately, you know, even more in Asia. But, when the world was at its darkest time, without doubt, at least in modern history, at its darkest time, you know, the light on the hill was held by, I hate to say it, but generally by English-speaking nations, you know, led by America and Britain. We were there, the Canadians were there. And I think one of the great things that the two nations have in common is this. We had no obligation, except for what we thought was right or wrong, to go to a lot of these wars, and nor did America. We're a little country, population-wise, a little country stuck down at the bottom of the globe. And, the call went out, and I think, you know, a lot of Australians answered it in a very, very fine fashion. And I think that's true of America. And I think it's those things, as you say, that bind us. And those are really important things. You know, whether we have to watch some really bad American TV programs, I think is really trivial. But, stuff like that. There'll always be problems, between nations. But underneath it all, is there goodwill? Yes, enormous amount of goodwill at every level, I think, in Australia.
I've got to ask you, it's not on our agenda, but I want to get your reaction because this was conducted around Perth, Australia so much. The missing Malaysia Airlines plane. Isn't that bizarre?
Well, you know, now they're having an argument today about who's going to pay for it. The cost has gone through the roof.
It's astronomical.
Yeah. And Australia's getting stuck with it at the moment. And there is no agreement between, you know, obviously there were so many Chinese nationals on board. It's a Malaysian aircraft. And it happened to, well, who knows if it crashed anywhere near us. I mean, nobody seems to know. But we've got stuck with the bill.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, whilst this might not be, you know, a huge amount of money compared to, the Defense Department's budget here in America, in Australia it's causing quite a degree of agitation because there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. And I fear that our taxpayers are going to get stuck with it. And, you know, the big question to me in that case is that the Malaysian military saw the plane on their radar and didn't scramble the jets. I don't know. I mean, what's the point of having radar if you're not going to have a look at it?
You know, part of me believes, Terry, that this plane is on land somewhere.
Well, this is probably the storyteller in me. And it's not just for the people, who are on board of that.
And there's a movie here.
I think that'd be the greatest thing ever.
There's a movie here. I think maybe you got to knock one out on this one.
It's definitely a movie. I mean, if it is in the water, you know, that's one thing. If it's on land, we're witness to one of the greatest stories of this century.
God. Yes, because and the story hasn't unfolded yet.
No, and it's just, I think, you know, yourself and everybody listening, had never known anything like it. It has just completely vanished. And the more you read about it, the more you realize they have no idea where they're looking.
No, not at all. What if the plane is loaded with smallpox, for example? Mm. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, up until now, we had that guy called D.B. Cooper, I think his name was, the guy out the plane with the money.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a reasonable sort of mystery. But that's got nothing on this. Nothing. And, you know, who knows what was on board the plane? Because, you know, you think, oh, no, that's too far-fetched. Unfortunately, so often what is far-fetched becomes the truth.
It does. I had a call Friday night during my open lines, Terry, where a caller said that he knows that the plane was carrying some specialized military weaponry and that it was being smuggled to China. We found out about it, and we took control of the plane, claiming that we have that capability now ever since 9/11, mm-hmm. and landed it in Diego Garcia, took that equipment back, and the passengers are all dead. Who knows, right?
Wow.
Who knows?
Yeah. Diego Garcia was one of the great staging posts and listening posts for many, many of the darkest things that have happened, you know, at least in my lifetime.
It's crazy. It really is. Anyways, let's talk a little bit about the energy, because that was the impetus for Mad Max and the Road Warrior. I'm a believer that this planet is abiotic with oil, that it's part of the planet. It was formed. It's not, you know, plankton and vegetation and dead dinosaurs. Doesn't mean we should be using it as a fuel, but I just think there's an abundance on this planet with that. Where do you see us headed energy-wise? Are we really headed toward the Mad Max stage?
Well, we will be if certain events occur. And look, you know, there's, you know, years ago there's a book written called The Seven Sisters about the multinational oil companies. And I think this is probably true of all multinationals now, that they are a law unto themselves.
Yes.
It's beyond the ability of any one government to control or even monitor what they're doing. These are supranational entities. Now, that's one thing if you're Google or Apple or, you know, Microsoft. That's one thing. It's an entirely different thing when you're dealing with the lifeblood of communities, nations, industry, as you would with, you know, the oil companies. So we place so much of our future and so much of our welfare in the hands of people who we don't even know who they are. It's distorted foreign policy throughout the whole world. I have no doubt in my own mind that if Saudi Arabia did not have the pump as much oil as it does, that America would speak out, and so would Australia, far more loudly and far more effectively about human rights abuses in that country.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, their abuses are unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's not a democracy. We're opposed to any country that does not have one. Mm-hmm. But with the Saudis, we seem to let them skate with everything, don't we?
Absolutely. Do you know, in Saudi Arabia, the people that guard the royal family, and it's a huge royal family because, you know, it's tribally based and all of those things. I think it's 28,000 people who are considered members of the royal family. Well, the people that guard them, you know, like in America, you have Americans in the Secret Service who ensure the security of the president. Mm-hmm. And we would think that's a pretty normal thing, except, of course, in Saudi Arabia, that's not normal because they are all Pakistanis. And the reason they're Pakistanis is because the Saudi royal family certainly wouldn't trust any other Saudi Arabians to ensure their safety. So that's a pretty healthy index, isn't it?
Right. And I bet those Pakistani guards are making a small fortune.
Absolutely. I mean, they're mercenaries. Call them whatever you like. That's what they are. Just imagine what it would be like in Australia if the people whose job it is to ensure the safety of our prime minister were to be from Yemen. People might scratch their heads. If the Secret Service was suddenly to be occupied by a group of Fijians, I think Americans might say there's something weird going on here. But that is how distorted life is. You know, in Saudi Arabia, you have two major state security groups. One is the Mahabharit, who are the, you know, the secret police. And then you have the religious police. Well, I'm sure you probably remember it yourself as something that I've never forgotten. The girls' school dormitory is burning down. The girls, of course, start to flee. They're forbidden by the religious police, driven back in because they were unveiled.
Yes.
They were not wearing their veils.
Horrendous.
Yeah, I mean, and now, if that does, I mean, I have always a very interesting question, both for Australia and America, and that is this. How do we feel about Yemen? Well, we don't feel so good about Yemen because it is a country of, you know, where democracy has never taken root, where some abuses are just really terrible. And we speak out about that. And, you know, quite loudly. But, of course, Yemen doesn't have any oil. So we do that. Its neighboring state of Saudi Arabia, nobody says anything about.
No.
And that is just
or
one
Kuwait,
example.
Or Bahrain or any of those areas.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Bahrain is the home of the American fleet in that region. And, you know, the crackdown on pro-democracy supporters has been pretty horrendous there. Now, anywhere else, America and Australia, Britain, you know, Germany, any number of countries are trying to support democracy, but not when it comes to certain nations where, you know, strategic or fuel or oil policy is more important. There's been only six countries in the world, George, that have had democracy for 100 years uninterrupted or longer. Six countries. It is a rare and valuable thing. America, of course, is one. Australia happens to be another. Canada, Britain, and, you know, I think Sweden, I forget the last one. But anyway, it's six. It's a rare and precious thing. And maybe it's part of our fate to try to, you know, foster and encourage this in the world. But it sure ain't getting anywhere when it interferes with multinational corporations or when it interferes with energy policy and certain strategic interests. It's a tragedy.
So true. So true. I mean, wars are fought over it. And, you know, I'm convinced part of the problem with Iran is because of the oil.
You know, all the Western countries supported the Shah of Iran because of the need to preserve, you know, the flow of oil. And so in supporting the Shah of Iran, all of us managed to offend the Iranian people to such an extent, because the more he cracked down on democracy or his own people, the more disgusted, the citizens became.
Yep, you're right. Plus he had his group Savak chasing people all over the place. We're going to come back more with you, Terry, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you ever find yourself not near your radio and you're panicking, you can't listen to the program, just grab your phone. You've got iHeartRadio. iHeartRadio app is available free from the stores. And if you happen to be by your computer, you've also got iHeartRadio.com. So take advantage of it and download the app. Back with Terry Hayes. Terry, so you're traveling around the country. The book, obviously, is available for folks at bookstores and Amazon, no doubt.
Yeah. It went on release about 9 or 10 days ago, and we've had a terrific response. It came out a little time back in the UK, and it's number four on the bestseller list there, at on a bestseller list in Australia, which is to be expected, because I did a lot of promotion down there. And yeah, it's out in Italy and Germany and France, I think Poland this week. So yeah, it's done really well and continues to build and grow.
What is Pine Gap in Australia?
Any of your listeners know, I think we'd all like to know down in Australia. Pine Gap, just after the, in the early 1950s, really, the Western nations, you know, led by Britain and America, formed a thing called Echelon. And Echelon is, used to be,
not it's an much. NSA program, isn't it?
Yeah. And it sweeps the world for electronic communications. It was once one of the most secret things in the world. But so five nations got together, formed Echelon, and decided they could pretty much cover the world with listening posts. And that's one of the reasons Diego Garcia is of interest. But one of the biggest of those is a place in a fairly remote part of Western Australia, called Pine Gap. And Pine Gap is a listening post. It sweeps up every electronic communication, you know, in any format, from all of the, you know, huge sweep, not only of Australia, of course, but all across Asia. And it covers a vast amount of space, and and these are where the satellites so download all of this stuff into Pine Gap. But no Australian's ever been into Pine Gap. It's guarded by U.S. Marines. It's on Australian soil, but it is not in any way, shape, or form a part of Australia. It is a American military installation on Australian territory doing God knows what.
Well, we've got them here all over the place. Area 51, you name it, we've got it.
So it's one of these typical things where whenever anybody asks about facilities like this, we're told that these are really useful and that it's wonderful, and that in the Australian case of Pine Gap, it enables us to, by us doing this, then America shares all of its intelligence, which of course it doesn't, but it shares the intelligence which it chooses to with Australia. So we allow them this facility and make it work. In return, we get intelligence and information that we would normally not have access to. Well, that's fine, but who's keeping an eye on what is actually happening? I mean, how does anybody know if the intelligence that we're getting is accurate, the full story, or indeed worthwhile? Nobody. We just have to take this, I guess, on trust. And I don't know, the recent history of the world shows that, you know, maybe things taken on trust is not the wisest decision.
Terry, if the world ends, is it going to be a calamity from above, something, like an asteroid, or is it going to be man-made?
For me, I mean, look, there's nothing we can do about asteroids and that. So, if that happens, that happens. But I think the history of the world shows that nearly all disasters are man-made. And I figure it will be as a result of our actions or inactions. I mean, what you and I have been talking about with energy policy, people have been banging the drum about this for years. Does anything happen? No. I'm banging the drum about biological weapons. And I'm not the only person. I just happen to use it in a fictional book that I hope, can raise people's consciousness a little. Do I think that anybody is going to read this and say, oh, my God, we better do something about this? That would be lovely, but I doubt it. Tom Clancy wrote a book many years before 9/11 about passenger jets being seized and used as missiles, flying them into buildings.
Yep.
Did anything happen? No. I mean, I get on a plane now and I look at those cockpit doors. You know, I look, you know, I go through the screening process, which, you know, all of us have to go through. And, you know, and I have no objection to that. Of course, we all want to be safe. But I look at all of this and I think, but where was it when we really needed it? And it wasn't there. We are, in all of the Western world, extremely reactive. We're not proactive. And so when you say, how do we think the world's going to win? I think we can come up with a number of scenarios. And we're, you know, are we aware of them now? Yeah. But we will only react. If somebody arrives in America tomorrow with smallpox, then, my God, you know, something will be done. Prior That's to right. that, it doesn't seem like there's, you know, much urgency, which is, you know, a terrible tragedy.
It always seems to go that way, too. They're just never prepared.
Yeah, yeah. And look, one of the themes of the book is, you know, because it's a great epic story, I managed to deal a lot with a thing that is always been of quite some interest to me, and that is the, you know, the history of the rise of, you know, Nazi Germany and of Nazism, you know, in that, what was thought of as at the time as an extraordinarily civilized country. And, you know, the writing was on the wall from 1932 onwards. You only had to read what Hitler was saying. It wasn't like he kept it secret. And nobody paid any attention.
No, he gave us a blueprint for what he was going to do, didn't he?
He wrote a book called Mein Kampf, you know, My Struggle. And, you know, it's a pretty turgid piece of writing, but, you know, this is a guy that became the Chancellor of Germany. It might have, you know, been advisable for people to have read it. If you were listening, you know, paying attention in Germany or Eastern Europe in, let's say, 1935, 1936, and let's say you were Jewish, you would have thought it was a very good idea to get the hell out.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a thing in human beings where you never quite expect the worst to happen. And I draw this
until it's too late, Terry.
Exactly, George. You know, I try to teach my kids that you have to always anticipate that the worst is going
to
happen because that's what history teaches you.
That's right. Exactly. And if you do, I think you're better prepared. You know, we've been talking about the grid possibly could go down because of a magnetic EMP pulse from the sun, or worse, someone detonates a nuke in the atmosphere. I mean, we've been trying to warn people about all these things. Government still hasn't done anything. They haven't insulated the grid. They could, but they haven't.
Because governments, all bureaucracies suffer from this terrible inertia. And it's only a crisis that seems able to get the machinery moving. Unfortunately, the crises that we confront become increasingly existential. You know, as you say about the grid, if the grid were to collapse, the economy wouldn't last a day.
No. And we're all electronic now. Everything is.
Yep. Yep. And if we were back in the days of horse and buggies and the first electric lights, you know,
or kerosene
lamps.
No, kerosene lamps, we'd be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But now we are totally reliant, unfortunately, on things that we don't understand. I don't think there is any one person who actually understands the grid. There is not one person who understands all the threats that confront the Western world. And so this diffusion of responsibility or knowledge and that makes it increasingly difficult. Personally, this is just a personal view. It's not in the book or anything. But I think that many, many communities, countries in the world, are virtually too big to manage. I think they've outgrown human scale, and I think in that is a huge, huge threat.
I think so, too. Let's talk a little bit about movies before we get to the top of the hour, and we'll take phone calls with you, Terry, next hour. When you wrote and co-produced Dead Calm, tell me what that concept was.
It was like a film school concept. Two boats, three people, one dog, tell a story. Under $3 million, had to be made in Australia, and shooting on water is a nightmare. What were we thinking? I don't know. I set to and wrote the story. I was very, very fortunate. I had a director called Phil Noyce who went on to make huge Hollywood movies, a couple from Tom Clancy books, and the idea was to put the audience through the most extreme experience that we could, you know, of a real thriller in a very unusual environment. And I think the movie still has quite a degree of currency. It still seems to play pretty well, and of course it did give Nicole a huge career. But I'm very proud of the movie, because I think it was it didn't have a lot of it certainly didn't have the budget, but didn't have a lot of the things that you can use today to make a movie, really go out there and knock an audience around. We just had to do it with ingenuity.
You know, I was looking at some old movies last week, you know, John Wayne movies where he was in the Calvary, mm-hmm. and, you know, other movies like that. And, you know, those movies would be huge box office flops today, wouldn't they?
Oh, without doubt. Look, storytelling and movie making has changed so enormously. But, movies started really by filming just spectacle. That's the history of the movies. I mean, when, you know, motion pictures were first invented, I mean, they put up a camera and they showed waves rolling in on a beach. They showed a train crossing a landscape, and everybody went, whoa, wow, isn't this incredible? It was just spectacle. But then Hollywood being Hollywood, that ran out of steam very fast, and they went into narrative storytelling. And there was a huge repository of this because there were endless books, plays, God knows what, that you could draw from. Well, that well started to run dry. And that really, that's the period that you're speaking of with, you know, that what we think of as the golden era of Hollywood. But now Hollywood's gone back to spectacle, and it's pretty hard to find a good story amongst all of this.
That's right.
Because we've got computer-generated effects. So you can go along and see things that are spectacular, but it doesn't have that deep-seated emotional connection that, you know, the movies from that golden era do.
It's all high action, but that's about it.
Yeah, a lot of sound and fury, maybe not too much meaning. I mean, I've got two boys. I think I mentioned I've got four kids, but I've got two boys, 1 7, 1 9. And I take them to movies a lot. And I see it in them, you know. I say, do you like that movie? They say, oh, this was cool. Or that was a great scene, or gee, wasn't that interesting? And I say, well, what about the story? And they look at me like I'm crazy.
Well, aren't most movies too now, Terry, made for younger audiences?
Yeah, absolutely. They're made for my 7 and 9 year old. And that's the demographic. You know, I mean, it's a bit older than that. But yes, I mean, so what happened is that older people tend not to go to the movies. So the studios say, well, that's not our audience. So you get this, you know, self-reinforcing cycle of, well, our audience is younger people, so we make movies for younger people. That proves that only younger people go. And that's why TV has become the place of great storytelling, great narrative structure, and has, you know, especially cable, and that has really picked up a huge audience. I mean, I sit through, I mean, how many Avengers movies can I sit through with my kids? I mean, there's a limit, you know, to the Marvel comic movies that I can watch. And so I turn to TV, and that's happening all around the world.
You know, I remember the even the comedians of the old days, they were all older guys, the Jack Bennies, the George Burns, the people like that. They would not make it these days.
Oh, no. They, you know what everybody says now, you've got to have an edge. You've got to have, you know, you've got to be straight. And in many cases, as far as I can work out, both in Australia, America, England, it's all the same, means using increasingly shocking language. That's fine. I don't have a problem with it, except that I was always taught that if you had to revert to that, it showed a lack of vocabulary more than anything else.
That's right.
So, yeah, no, they wouldn't make it. But that, you see, so many of those guys and women, they came out of a different culture of entertainment. I mean, when you think about the number of people who could be stand-up comedians, they could sing, they could dance, and then they acted. And this was the vaudeville and then the Broadway tradition. You were a multiple threat player. And that's not true anymore. I you look at Danny Kaye. I mean, the guy was incredible in all the talents that he had. We don't see that much anymore.
It is amazing how times have simply changed, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, at the expense of sounding like an old fogey or something, which I try not to be, not always for the better. I showed my kids not so long ago. I showed them Sammy Davis Jr. on YouTube singing Mr. Bojangles.
He was one of the best.
He was incredible. And, you know, he had been part of a traveling vaudeville show, I think, with his dad and his uncle.
When he was a little kid, a little boy.
He was tiny. And he grew up in that. And then you see him do Mr. Bojangles. And I will say, all four of my kids watched it, and it moved me to tears, and it gave them a different perspective on, you know, what they think of as entertainment. These were real masters of entertainment, and none of them were getting paid $25 million a picture, I can tell you.
So you have an email in from a fellow by the name of Tony, who's from the Australian Financial Innovations Company in Sydney. Oh. And he says, I'm listening to you right now. Love you, Americans. And I love hearing Terry's Aussie accent.
There you go. Thank you very much. Many years ago, when I was 21, I went to New York and I wasn't married and, and it was all a bit overwhelming. And not so many people didn't travel as much then, and an accent was a more unusual thing. And I used to say it was worth two puppies. You could meet any girl you liked if you had an accent.
You sure could. Dave, Terry, we're going to take this break and then we're going to come back. And we're going to take phone calls with you in the final hour. We'll talk about Mad Max, talk about energy, talk about the viruses, you name it. We've got it. The phone lines will be open on Coast to Coast AM. Do go to our Twitter feed, if you would. Take a look at the little child with smallpox. You won't believe that, if you can handle that. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And you can also track us by going to our website and like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We will be back with our final hour with Terry Hayes as we talk about his work. I am Pilgrim on Coast to Coast AM.